You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hello, listeners. Sorry to interrupt your show, but we've got a small favour to ask. We're currently doing a bit of a survey to find out more about you, your podcast listening habits, and the sort of adverts that are most relevant to you. If you feel like helping, please head to surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. That's pretty catchy, so I'll say it one more time. surveymonkey.com/r/athleticaudiouk. Thank you.
Hello, and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I'm joined now by Alex Stewart.
Good morning, Joe.
Seb Stafford-Blore.
Hello.
Yeah, very excited to be here today. We have a number of things on the list, the plan list discussion plan, and I will start by listing the things that we are going to discuss here. We've got points about Chelsea versus Atletico. Is it Callum Hudson-Odoi as a comeback thing? 3-4-2-1, a game of two nines. Joe's VAR hot take. That was an exciting bit. We've also got some stuff on Jamal Musiala from the Lazio buy-in game. Seb watched that one. Atalanta-Real Madrid, hot dog, that was a boring game. And also a team bought a pitch. So we'll talk about that too. Very excitingly, we also have a fantasy football update for you all in this podcast, something we kind of forgot we did at the beginning of the season. But we brought it back with the star and aplomb for today's episode. So I hope you can all enjoy the things that we discuss today. But before you do that, I want you to go to the internet and type in theathletic.com/TIFO. And why do I want you to do that? Because when you're there and you've signed up with a deal, I don't know what the deal is right now, but it'll be a good one, and for not very much money, you'll have access to the full array of quality products from The Athletic. What am I saying, Seb? I'm trying to say something here, aren't I?
You're trying to promote The Athletic, Joe, and you're stumbling towards it. But there's a lot of good stuff on it, actually. I'm going to point people in the direction of, we talked about Jamal Musiala, and we do talk about this during the segment, but do go and read Rafa Honigstein's interview with him, because it's very interesting. Also, Jamal comes across really well, obviously a thoughtful young guy, and yeah, well worth reading.
Do you know what comes up the top of my feed today, because the feeds are sometimes specific to different people. Top of my feed is an exclusive with Ian Rush, backing company, buying grounds of grassroots clubs. There we go. But listen, that's a pretty bad advert, frankly, but a fantastic product, The Athletic. If you visit theathletic.com/TIFO, you can avail yourselves of the things that we have just described and many more better things than the things we've just described. That's all for the intro. For now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of Callum Hudson-Odoi in narrative form. Okay, let's begin with the Atletico 0-1 Chelsea game. There were some interesting talking points from this. The first one I'm going to draw on is the Callum Hudson-Odoi talking point, starting at wingback, which was interesting because he was subbed off as a sub last game, as we discussed on this week's earlier podcast. And Tuchel called him out specifically regarding his attitude after that game, which felt like quite a harsh thing to do. We talked about that at the time, and we questioned the motives. You know, this choice immediately in the game immediately afterwards sort of appeared to show that, you know, he had was given a specific and immediate opportunity to change Tuchel's mind, and seemed to do fairly well in this position. So I wonder if this was all intended by the new Chelsea coach. Alex, what were your thoughts on his performance? Because for a player who has their attitude, particularly related to pressing, criticised, Placing that attacking player in a position where they have require a lot of defensive output in the next game seems like an odd thing to do.
Yeah, slightly weird. I mean, I guess against an Atletico Madrid team that is relatively likely to sit off, that does afford the wingbacks an opportunity to get forwards. It's also worth noting that Tuchel is very consistent in using certain styles of build-up play that tend to create quite a degree of solidity through the centre of the pitch, and that allows, and in fact encourages, the wing-backs to get forwards. So Tuchel's wing-backs are probably more attacking than some other wing-backs you would see in a kind of 3-5-2 system or a 3-4-3 system. But yeah, I think he did quite well. I mean, there was, I guess, perhaps sometimes a little more energy than precision in the way that he pressed, but being up against Thomas Lemar, who was also quite kinetic but not necessarily all that focused, it seemed to work well. He got back and doubled up. There was a nice moment fairly early on where he won a good interception and was able to play the ball sensibly square and then progress up the pitch. So yeah, I think he did pretty well. I mean, it'll be interesting to see whether this becomes his kind of default role. Obviously it would give Chelsea more of an attacking impetus down that right hand side with perhaps a more traditional left wing back on the other side. He certainly has the ball carrying attributes, and he does have the energy. It's about whether he can just add maybe a little more focus to the way he presses, not just sort of charging after the ball quite so much.
Yeah, Seb, I mean, I want to pick up on that point Alex has made there, because, as you say, the criticism after the last game related to his attitude, particularly, well, specific to the pressing. And as Alex notes there, perhaps the precision wasn't always there, but the intention and the energy always was, right? If Tuchel's intention was to try and spark a response from him, I think we seem to see, I know you didn't focus on this game specifically, but we seem to see that from him. Is that smart management now? Because I know our opinion of it earlier in the week was a little different.
I think it depends over the long term, Joe. I mean, I think it's one of those things you can maybe get away with once or twice, and possibly as a new manager, new coach, new voice in the dressing room. But if you were to do that more than once, so if, for instance, the next time Chelsea drop points or have a disappointing performance, Tuchel repeats the trick, I think it starts to wear a little bit thin, and different players with different personalities are going to react to it in different ways. So you have to be super careful, I think.
Yeah. Okay. Alex, Chelsea played a 4-2-3-1, right, in this game. It looked really tidy to me. I mean, the first thing I would say is that I liked this team when I watched them. I know that they were missing a couple of players, and I know that they were relying on Olivier Giroud, and that short of a pretty incredible overhead kick, they didn't create a huge number of chances. But watching the team, I liked the way they moved the ball around. I liked that they were positive, whether that was, you know, coming off or not in terms of chance creation. Was their setup specifically to counter Atletico, you know, given that they were away in Europe? Or is this a system that Tuchel's used regularly in the past, Chelsea can use regularly now?
It's hard to say, because one of the things about Tuchel is that he's, in terms of his system, he's quite flexible. But that does largely depend on the players that he has available. I think what you can see, though, is that the patterns of build-up are really quite similar to what he was using at PSG. So he creates this kind of diamond in deep progression. He likes a midfielder to drop off. He likes to be able to create passing options for the central centre-back in a three. If he's using a four-man back line, then you'll have the same sort of shape, but a wing back will, a full back will stay deeper. And then as the ball moves up centrally, you can see, you know, the wing backs getting forwards or wide players splitting out. I think there's enough in what he's doing currently, based on how he played at PSG, to see that he is working towards a particular style of play. I think he maybe feels that Chelsea's defenders aren't necessarily strong enough to do that as a four-man back line, and so he's using a three at the moment because of that added degree of solidity. Jorginho as well can drop back and spray passes around, but isn't necessarily the kind of defensive screening midfielder you'd want sitting in front of a two. I think what he needs to do, you know, the possession is there, obviously. You know, the first game that he played, they racked up an insane number of passes. So keeping the ball that's clearly a focus that he's working on and it's going well. I think what he just needs to do is start to achieve a little more movement between the lines, particularly among the front three. And then you'll start to see Chelsea become slightly more attacking and slightly more effective in the final third. But it's definitely progressing, I think, in the right way, and you can see why he's trying to do what he's trying to do.
The other thing about this game, watching it, was that it felt very much like a game of two nines, because Suarez and Giroud were both, I mean, really isolated for the majority of the game. Giroud's only moment was his goal, terrifically taken, of course, but resulting from a bit of luck since he was in an offside position when the ball came to him, even though it came off an Atleti defender. But other than this, he almost completely disappeared into the game and was rarely found by his teammates. So it's not a suggestion that it was his fault or it was his performance's fault. But as a result of the way that the game played out, he was barely involved at all other than the goal. Suarez, similarly, he struggled to contribute effectively to goal chances. But as Glenn Hoddle said during the commentary, he was never out of the game. And this is mostly because he makes such a nuisance of himself. And basically, Alex, I'd forgotten how much of a dick he plays like. I mean, like, such a dick, right? He plays like...
Yes, I guess so. I mean, what you had here was two systems where, you know, obviously Atleti are looking to counterattack. The striker is there both as a kind of pressing option, but also to be a focal point for those long release passes. And Chelsea aren't quite getting the movement between... The front three with the two wider players dropping off and tucking in to be able to link that. So it's quite understandable in Atletico Madrid's case because of the system and in Chelsea's case because they've not quite found a way of gelling that forward line together. And I think Tuchel is still experimenting with the options. And it's interesting to me that, you know, Havertz, Ziyech, the kind of players who might actually be quite effective in that role haven't been particularly used so far in it. Maybe he wants a greater degree of movement. He doesn't want a 10 to kind of fixate on being the creative force, because what he's actually looking for is movement and dynamism rather than a certain type of passing. But it's interesting that, you know, the nines were isolated, yes, but they were isolated for quite different reasons.
I mean, Suarez did some diving. He did some thigh pinching. He did a little bit of grabbing. He did, you know, what the commentary team would refer to as gamesmanship, and which, again, they would repeatedly refer to as something which Simeone would enjoy. Seb, he would, if you were a defender, he would be a horrible striker to face, right?
If you were a defender facing him, if I were a defender facing him, I would get sent off, because I would just have to kick him at some point, or stamp on him, or elbow him, or... He's in that kind of Jamie Vardy bracket. You know, he's just like a little relentless sort of mosquito type forward.
Sure, just, a terrier.
He's probably someone who, when a corner is being taken, just very gently, very subtly, steps on a defender's toes with his studs. He's that kind of player. Or just pinches you under the arm, or, you know, punches you very gently on the funny bone. He's that kind, isn't he? He's the kind of player that you just have to retaliate to. Do you remember, you know, when you watch like videos of, well, not videos, but highlights and footage of games from the 60s and 70s, and every now and again, a referee just steps away and allows two players to have a bit of a punch up. So think about Keegan and Bremner in that charity shield, the Leeds Liverpool charity shield. It's that, isn't it? Eventually you just think, oh God, just let them go. It becomes a little bit of a hockey fight. And eventually you've just got to allow a defender just to take a swing at those Suarez, I think, to be fair.
Yeah. He reminds me of the sort of kids that you would get in school in the 2000s and the 90s, the young kids who realised very quickly that they weren't really ever going to get in that much trouble, and that they knew where the line was. So if they kind of just fluffed over the line frequently enough but never did anything super serious... they could get away with it most of the time, because violence has left communities. You know what I mean? I feel like if you did this 400 years ago, you'd be dead. Someone would kill you. And that's why people didn't do it before. But now, I'm not advocating for murder or violence, by the way. I'm just saying there's that line now, because we're a civilized society. So there's a line, and retaliation is considered, you know, as bad as proactively provoking people.
I feel like that character at school, he or he would sort of flirt with the lines over the course of a school year, and then eventually, like, he would do something menial and the teacher would chuck a board rubber at them. It's right. That kind of, it's just,
this
it's a kind of a cumulative effect.
This happened in my school with one particular child and one particular teacher, and the child wound the teacher up so much over the process of a couple of years, probably, that one day all the child was doing was he was like 13 years old. He was stood up out of his desk and he was kind of stealing somebody else's pencils in plain view of everybody else, and he'd been asked to stop and he hadn't stopped. The poor teacher just snapped and came over and grabbed him by the arm and pushed him back into his seat. And then left the room, and we never saw him again. He was sacked.
Well, the teacher.
And I remember thinking, like, that's kind of a dick thing. I mean, I think we can let that one slide. I know it's a child, 13 years old, teenager maybe, but we're really down memory lane now. Let's reverse this, and we'll what was I going to say? I was going to say something about Luis Suarez.
A teacher once taped my mouth shut.
Good advice. I'm going to do the same now and say Suarez, he must know that people don't like him, right? But he mustn't care. Is that fine? I mean, you know, there's that branch of thinking in football that winning is the only thing that matters, and however you do it, you know, is sort of just doesn't matter at all. He's going to go down as a fantastic player, but people, particularly I suppose in the UK, the fans of the Premier League will never forget some of those transgressions, will they? Does that impact legacy, Seb? Or do you think in 50 years' time, what will be the thing that's more remembered about him?
I suppose it depends on how we argue these things in 50 years' time. Because at the moment, Luis Suarez is just a topic to have a big online ruck about, isn't he? We won't go into the sort of the full list of offences he committed while he was in the UK, but you either hate Luis Suarez or you support Liverpool, and there isn't much crossover between them. But that's purely in the UK. But I think you're right. I think one of the sort of the within the game, and certainly within the kind of community of football players, I think it's quite telling that a lot of the people that play with Luis Suarez really like him. Like he's a very close friend of Leo Messi's, for instance. The Atletico players speak very highly of him now. He's one of those.
Well, if he's on your team, he plays, he's your ally.
Exactly,
right?
Exactly. He's the guy that you go to war with, basically. So I understand that, but I've always hated him. I can't understand. Sure. Sorry, said anything about him.
Sure, Alex. One word response: love or hate?
Ambivalent.
Okay, there we go. He's found the third word. No wonder that teacher taped your mouth shut. Joe's VAR hot take now. Are you ready for a hot take about VAR? It's an exciting hot take about VAR.
Do we have a jingle for this section, though? Or will we?
No, because this is not going to repeat and I'm not wasting my time. I'll just go, Joe's VAR hot take. Joe's VAR hot take. Welcome to Joe's VAR hot take. VAR, better when you can't see the replays. And I say that because of the following. Atletico Madrid, Chelsea. Of course, the Olivier Giroud goal. Giroud was in the offside position. It turned out that it was tapped back to him by one of the defending team, so it wasn't offside. But there was a long old hoo-ha about this, and you really notice how long it is when the local director doesn't show you the replays and doesn't show you the footage that the VAR or the virtual assistant referees are seeing. So we're very used to watching in the Premier League, where we see the little blue and the red line and endless focusing on the incident, and half the time it's really not that clear anyway, and I don't know why he's put the line there, and what am I looking at? This is really boring. When you don't see it, do you know what you do see? A melodrama. That's what you see. You see the faces of the players. You see the referee's face. That's the most interesting bit, because the referee is in an interesting social position at this moment in time, isn't he? The referee has stopped a game that is being televised to millions of people, stopped it for far longer than anybody should be comfortable with, and is trying to listen to his earpiece to catch up. He's reliant on other people being speedy about something in order for him to look less slow. He's trying to fend off the defenders who are shouting at him the whole time. He's still trying to maintain the veneer of control. He is one man on a pitch of 22 men, well, at this point, 21 men, all of whom could physically overwhelm him, overpower him, take over the stadium, you know? He could be ripped to shreds by the other men that are there. But the civilized society we were talking about before, the little veneer, the illusion of control, there he is, it's all in his face, and you know, the players are terrified. The Chelsea players are anxious. How will it work? Will they celebrate again when the goal does go in? Can you just pause joy? Can you? Who knows? This was like a three-act play in 2 minutes, watching these people's faces. This is way better than looking at static images with lines drawn on them. I mean, that's just boring. I don't care whether it's right or not, is what I've realised from this moment. I like VAR, not because it gets us to the right decision, but because it creates a drama. Who's with me?
You know that trope in soap operas or comedies, where a character is reminiscing and he kind of looks into the top right-hand corner of the screen? Well, that's kind of what I was doing while you were talking, because I just remembered that I had a teacher who threw an overhead projector out of a second story window.
Oh, for God's sake.
I'd completely forgotten
about
that.
This isn't about my hot take. This is about the teacher's thing.
You introduced it though, and I'm living in a kind of nostalgic days. So I'm completely useless for the rest of the podcast.
I remember when I had a teacher. I think I would have been in year 8 or something, and it was the first time I ever disobeyed a teacher to their face. The teacher held me back after a thing to tell me off, and instead of losing the attitude and becoming, "Oh, I'm ever so sorry," there, you know, which is what I would ordinarily do, I just went, "No." And I didn't say fuck off, but I as much as said fuck off without actually swearing. And you know what? Nothing happened. Nothing happened because of the veneer. This is a theme in today's podcast, the illusion of control. Alex is a football expert. He's sixth in a league of his team members. I think everything's fine. It's not fine. Nothing's fine. You know, no one's in charge of anything. Civilization falls apart. Look what's happened. Civilization has fallen apart. Actually, everyone's adapted pretty well to the pandemic, haven't they? We'll be back after the break to talk about Lazio and Bayern.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The 7-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Okay, Lazio 1, 4 Bayern Munich. Jamal Musiala is the sort of our main talking point from this, because we are an Anglophone podcast. Yeah, we speak English, and Jamal Musiala also speaks English, but treachery. No, not treachery at all. He was born in Germany, grew up in England. He's just chosen to represent Germany as a senior international. I feel the same as when Adnan Januzaj chose Belgium. But it worked out okay, didn't it? Very positive here, though, in this game. Played as a 10 between Sane and Koeman, sitting in front of Goretzka and Kimmich. Seb, you enjoyed this game, didn't you? Tell me your thoughts on Jamal Musiala.
Yeah, I enjoyed it for a little bit. Lazio were a little bit of a disaster because they produced a first half full of mistakes, which Bayern inevitably capitalised on and built a 3-0 unassailable lead. But I did enjoy watching Jamal Musiala. It's funny because in any other generation, a player like that, it would feel like more of a drama, him choosing to play for Germany. But one of the aspects of this situation is that one of the reasons why Germany coveted him so much, and why Jogi Löw made such an attempt to secure his international future, is, as Rafa Honigstein points out in his excellent article on this, is that Germany are lacking individualists. They don't have the kind of the individual talented players that currently England are kind of overwhelmed by in that area of the pitch. Musiala is most likely to be a kind of a modern number 10. He'll roam and he'll sort of sit at the head of a midfield and he'll create. England aren't really without that type. I mean, obviously we were just about to I think by the time this podcast released, we will also have released a video about Phil Foden's international future. But you can add in players like James Maddison and Dele Alli, James Ward-Prowse, Jude Bellingham. You know, these players who aren't necessarily exactly the same, but who could potentially occupy the same area of the pitch. But he's funny. He's 17 years old, and he's one of those players who looks like he plays like he's 25 already. You know, one of the types that come along every now and again who... It's as if someone has just dropped them into the middle of a pitch with a lifetime's worth of experience, because he just looks so ready to play at that level. And it's quite striking to watch.
Are you saying we don't need him there, Seb? Because that's what I'm hearing.
No, it's not that we don't need him. I just think he's made the right decision. When he spoke to Ralf Hoenigstein, he said that he wanted to represent the country of his birth. He was born in Stuttgart. And also, I think another point made in that article is that as a Bayern Munich player who is a German international, there's a special status that goes with that. Quite understandably, I suppose it's the same as being an England international who plays for Manchester United, for instance. And it's that sort of slightly intangible quality, but it's something desirable for a player. And for him also, if you're playing for a country where you're one of very few types of player, I suppose your pathway through to the senior international side looks a lot less cluttered. If you were a number 10 or a wide forward and you were 17 and English and only eligible to play for England, I think you could probably be very, very talented, have a very good Premier League career, but also run the risk of, you know, ending your career with fewer than 10 caps potentially. So it's logical. I completely understand why he's made the decision.
Yeah, well, as someone yourself who's just moved to Germany, I suppose this is all working out rather well for you, isn't it?
It sure is. It feels like him and I could become friends, you know?
Does it? Because he's only 17, Seb, and I feel that that's a little,
well, in the future,
a little uneasy
in the future.
About that. In the future.
Well,
how far in the future are we talking?
Well, yeah, a good 5 years. He also has a private school background, which helps. He went to Whitgift. You have a...
Fuck me.
He does. He went to Whitgift.
This is it, isn't it? Behind the veil. This is how it all works. Yeah. You've never even met him, but you already know you could be compatible because he has money too. That's how it works.
Well, it's... No, so he...
We'll feel the same way about our waiters. It's no problem, you know? We'll treat the poverty-stricken the same way. We see things equally for us only.
When you leave private school, you get given a key to the special clubs that allow you to just, you know, go in and
I can't really hear you,
Seb,
because of the noise of your guard dogs barking on the outskirts of your land.
There's obviously a peasant in the vicinity that needs chewing.
Someone's being torn apart. Anyway, what a disgusting look behind the curtain I want to encourage you, listeners, just some of the TIFO people, yeah? Not me. You and me, listener, we're cut from the same cloth, provided that you're cut from exactly the same cloth as me when you're listening. That cloth's called the paw. We'll be back after this to talk about maybe the most boring game that's ever happened in the world of football.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial, and with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown, and through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at marines.com.
Okay, Atalanta 0, 1 Real Madrid, hot dog. I've written here, boring. Quite interesting. When I wrote in boring with many zeros, about 8 zeros, into Google Docs, it came up with a little red squiggly line underneath, and I did the spell check, and it said, did you mean boring with 7 dots? And I thought, sure. Same thing. Here's a point I'd like to make. In a video we have coming out shortly about David Beckham's move to Real Madrid, Seb, you write about Florentino Perez and the first Galacticos era, and you talk about how Perez was, of course, keen to sign star players. Players were needed to create his ambition, but his ambition was really a footballing fantasy. And this is what we associate Real Madrid with. For better or worse, that's what we think of Real Madrid. Injuries we're going to come to, so we'll bear that in mind. But the performance last night was so rubbish, there was no escapism at all, with the exception of the lovely goal, we should say, from Fernand Mendy. First attempt on target was 40 minutes in, 20 minutes after the red card. This game made me want to stop watching the game.
I don't think I wasn't watching the game live. I watched it this morning. I don't think I got over the red card. It was an extraordinary decision. Did you guys, I remember watching and thinking, when a referee makes a decision that quickly, do you think you were kind of waiting for that? You wanted that moment and you seized upon it. That's the dynamic that I'm left with.
Yeah, also, he didn't ask, and like, he didn't seem to wait for any kind of VAR thing, or, I mean, there was no second opinion needed, was there? The thing I didn't like about it is I couldn't really get over it, but, you know, individual decisions I tried to leave at the side. But later in the game, Casemiro was clearly told off for diving after he'd already been given a yellow card. And as far as I understand the rules of the game, if he's been caught diving, he has to be given another yellow card, and he wasn't. And I feel that the sort of urgency with which the Atalanta defender Freuler, wasn't it, was given a red in the first half. No, you know, total discipline. That's fine. That's an approach to refereeing. I can respect and accept that when it's consistent. And I felt that it wasn't in the game.
With regards to Real Madrid, though, it's interesting that the point about Perez and the very first Galacticos era was all about aspiration, and Perez had that theory, which is kind of proven wrong, about how you didn't need holding midfielders and you didn't need to respect the unwritten laws of the game, and he was quite dismissive and sneering towards writers who, around the time that the first Galactico team was being put together, sort of talked about Real Madrid's imbalances. But yeah, fantasy has always been part of it, and this team, even the players that are meant to occupy that role, players like Rodrigo and Vinicius and I suppose Isco now, because he's just been there for so long, they just don't capture imagination. And I wonder whether this is partly because you still have the kind of the foundations, the aging foundations of that team that won those European Cups. And there hasn't been quite enough renewal of that side for it to be anything other than a lesser version of it was before, of what it was before, because, you know, at its heart, you've still got Modric, you've still got Cruz. Okay, Sergio Ramos was suspended last night, but it's very familiar. And the new players who have come into the side to replace, you know, others who've been moved on, aren't generational. They aren't, I mean, some of them are very good, but they aren't sufficiently excellent to give this new side any real identity. And mixed with what is quite a turgid and cautious playing style, it feels very un-Real Madrid. It feels like, at times, it can actually feel like watching Rafa Benitez's Valencia, which is, yeah. I mean, they were, no, I mean, they were, they yeah, were very accomplished, point. But, you know.
Seb, I'm going to pick up on a mistake you made there. You don't make very many of them, and I'm going to delight in this. You said Sergio Ramos was injured. You don't know. Oh, fuck, I've made a mistake. You said he was suspended. He's not. He had knee surgery, you prick. And he's back in April. I'm going to list the players. Let's sweep over that. I'm going to list the players now that are currently unavailable, Alex. We have Benzema, Ramos, Hazard, Carvajal, Marcelo, Rodrigo, Valverde, Odriozola, and Militao. Another interesting stat from this game is that 8 of Real Madrid's 11 goals in the group stages were scored by players unavailable for tonight's game. And another stat I stole from the BT commentary team, thanks BT, first time in 11 years that Madrid took group stage qualification to the final game. So it's clearly not like it's some injuries which are specific to this game or specific to this period are not just to blame for the poor performance here, because they weren't doing all too well prior to that as well. Also second in La Liga, chasing Atletico a few points behind and already a game more played. Alex, what's your take on this Real Madrid team? Because I'm sure, you know, we talked last week on the podcast about tactics being easy, ebb and flow being confusing. This game, they were just so patient and not in a fun way that it just seemed overly cautious, and that there was no spark. It was like trying to light a candle in a canal.
When have you ever tried to do that?
Last night.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I suppose that the issue is that with particularly with Kroos and Modric, you've got two players that are very good at retaining the ball and very good at circulating it. But unless you have movement up front from players that are dynamic, you're not going to get anything from that. And Isco is really an attacking midfielder. He was being used as a false nine, but you weren't getting those driving runs beyond. And I think it's noticeable that, you know, the best moment of the first half from a Real Madrid perspective was Nacho's run as a free centre-back. He wasn't picked up. There was space created for him, and he was able to drive forwards.
He cut through three players, didn't he?
Yeah, no, it was, I mean, it was really good. It was you said in the WhatsApp group it was quite like what Maguire does, and I think that's a very good point. When players are occupied by, or defending players are occupied by attacking players, sometimes there is space for a centre-back to drive forwards in that way. And also Mendy, who I thought had a really good game. He was probably Madrid's only bright spark, and that's not just the goal, although the goal was very well taken. But there were a couple of instances where he cropped up in the centre-forward position. He was making nice inverted runs, again, because Atalanta's sort of man-oriented press was taking care of Real's attacking players in a way that really only left their defenders open. And that's kind of a lack of dynamism from Real. They weren't making third-man runs. They weren't getting in behind the defence. They weren't really stretching too much. Isco was dropping off and helping to circulate the ball. But if there's no penetration, it doesn't matter how much possession you have, because it just ends up being really sterile and tedious. The squad needs a refresh. I mean, yes, obviously, if there's a huge number of players like that and high-quality players that are out injured, that's problematic. But also, if you look at those players, a lot of them are 30 or over. Yes, Valverde's younger, Odrizola's younger, but you know the core of that group is 30-plus. It's not necessarily a physical thing, although that does play a part. But also, as those players get older and older, without bringing in, as Seb says, these sort of generational talents, and nobody is realistically talking about, you know, Real Madrid being in a position to sign Mbappe or Haaland or any of these, you know, the upcoming generational talents, because financially, La Liga is just not in a position to compete. So it's difficult to see where that kind of level of renewal comes from. Real Madrid are always going to have the quality to be competitive in La Liga, because they just do. Even, you know, the players that are coming through the Castillo, good enough. But they're not looking like a side that can adequately compete in Europe anymore.
No. Okay. I mean, what I find interesting about it is looking at that list of injured players, the one who you think the team missed the most, particularly at the moment, is Benzema. And Benzema, 5 years ago, you know, there was a period where he was considered, obviously a fantastic player, but he was considered the one that could be swapped out for a new incoming transfer. You know, he was always the one in Madrid's sort of forward four or five that was the most expendable should they be able to go out and buy another Galactico player. And now we find ourselves in a situation where, you know, Benzema's still an absolutely fantastic player and has adapted his game and has found space and time that he wouldn't have ordinarily had when he was, you know, paired with Cristiano Ronaldo, for example. But now we have a situation where he's the most important and their biggest player in those areas. Anyway, that's Real Madrid. I'm sure we'll talk about them again in the future. And whenever we do, we'll talk about the death of a swan. So, you know, no worries. We'll be back to that. Next is Leeds, Southampton. Leeds 3-0 Southampton. But that's not what we're talking about here. Because the plan says, did you know that Leeds United bought a new hybrid pitch from Tottenham for £300,000, Seb?
Yeah, so I was watching Leeds Southampton and trying to fill the podcast plan, and there wasn't really anything particularly interesting about the game beyond a couple of good finishes and Southampton's lasting poor form. But a couple of weeks ago, Phil Hay wrote a report about Leeds's pitch suffered from snow and inclement weather at the turn of the year. And as a result, the top level of grass was infirm, and so players were just falling over. In fact, if you look back, there's a moment on Instagram where Jack Grealish commented on it. He was kind of sat at home watching some game or another, and he'd had a few difficulties at Elland Road himself, and he was kind of, you know, turfing out the Leeds ground staff. Anyway, the solution in the summer, long term, will obviously be to replace the pitch and to install a new draining surface, a new draining system even. Temporarily, what they've done is they've bought a new pitch from Tottenham, who just had one growing on the side, like a kind of Blue Peter Kitchen type way, and they paid £300,000 for it. I mean, it's a lot of money.
And they're going to return it?
No. They just grow it. So basically, as far as I understand it, Tottenham had a surplus of grass as a result of the lack of NFL fixtures at their stadium this season, for obvious reasons. And somehow that affects their... it has allowed them to grow a new pitch on the sly and sell it. Wow. And I just wondered how you would negotiate. Yeah, but how would you negotiate for that? Like, and also how would you begin the conversation? If you were Leeds United, do you phone up Daniel Levy and say, do you, or is it a conversation which happens between respective groundsmen? So, you know,
there's a specialist agent out there, Dr. Grass or something, who on the side, he sells marijuana, of course, but his main job is to value Premier League level pitches and trade them between teams.
Where does one keep a pitch? Is there like a hangar somewhere in Edmonton where it's just laid out and then they go in every so often and water it? Or
don't Tottenham have one under their pitch?
Yeah, so at Spurs, like at the Amsterdam Arena, you can kind of roll pitches out depending on what's happening at the stadium, and that includes obviously surfaces for concerts and what have you. But more in my mind, like, you buy a pitch, okay, so you hand over your $300,000, and then you have to transport it up to Leeds, and I just wanted to know how it gets there. So obviously, presumably lorries with. You know,
I would have thought so.
Maybe if you had what are those massive Chinook helicopters?
You could six of them, right?
Well, yeah.
Do you mean like the double blade ones you saw in like Vietnam films?
Exactly. And then you just lift it up. Like, it reminds me of that bit in the BFG where they're transporting one of the giants using Chinooks. It's just slung underneath.
Yeah,
that would work.
If you did that, you could use the pitch as a net to capture a giant, couldn't you? You could drop it over the top of King Kong.
How kind of tightly knitted the pitch is. And from watching the Leeds-Southampton game, I don't think it would hold a giant because it struggled with the players not falling over.
Well, there you go. Disappointing, I suppose. Listen, that was all a bit of fun, wasn't it? And now we're going to have some more fun before we end with Joe's player quotes and database facts. It's Joe's quotes and facts database. Yes, welcome again to the facts and quotes database. We have three new entrants today. All from Chelsea, because I thought we might talk about United-Chelsea, the game at the weekend, which we probably don't have time to do now. But I prepared these anyway, so let's begin. Seb, would you prefer to choose between Kepa Arrizabalaga, Willy Caballero, or Edouard Mendy? Or Antonio Rudiger? I've got four.
I want to go Edouard Mendy, please, Joe.
Oh, good choice, good choice. Fact about Edouard Mendy: Edouard Mendy, known as the tall doorkeeper. Yeah, pretty cool nickname, isn't it, as far as nicknames go?
Yeah, that's pretty good, yeah.
Yeah, his quote is the least good quote. Basically couldn't find him saying anything that was, you know, funny. But I did find, I thought if I read this in an interesting way, it might sound funny. I love this country. My sister has been living here for 7 years. It's beautiful to join her here. That's Edouard Mendy's quote there. So we have Kepa, Willy, or Antonio. Alex, who would you like?
I'd like Willy.
You want Willy, okay. Here's a fact about Willy. Cesc Fabregas bought him a £950 Range Rover after losing a bet the two had made. Yeah, that's a fact about...
£950? Is that weight?
Well, I think the bet was to buy... No. The bet was to buy a Range Rover. The loser would buy the other one a Range Rover. It's the kind of bet that young, wealthy men with nothing to do make. And I think the bet was something along the lines of, if you can save my shat, I'll buy you a Range Rover. And Willy Caballero did save it. So Cesc Fabregas was bound by social stricture to buy Willy Caballero a Range Rover. And what did he do? The cheeky little fella. he found him one from a scrapyard. And it cost him £950 sterling. And that's it. That's the story. So, you know, a story of waste and gambling there. And the fact about... No, that was the fact. The quote about Willy Caballero. I've got two quotes here because I felt that they didn't quite... It didn't quite line up. The first quote is, "The most important thing is to win. It doesn't matter how." But also, Willy Caballero said, "Life is the most important thing, always."
That's just deeply inconsistent, isn't it?
Exactly. And I wanted to highlight that inconsistency. The next two are really great. So I'm just going to start with Kepa Arrizabalaga. I don't know if you know this, but he loves birds. Did you know this? He's nicknamed the Birdmaster. His family constantly had birds in the house when he was growing up. Here's the quote from Kepa. I assume this is true. It might not be. I think it is. "Me and my dad participated in a lot of bird singing competitions over the years. We were lucky enough to win a lot of them, or our birds were simply better. I was the birds' coach. We took part in a lot of tournaments and showed good results for a number of years." There were many quotes to choose from with Kepa and his birds. I went with that one because originally I thought that his dad and he were actually imitating birds and singing in competitions, but that's clearly not true. But anyway, there you go. Kepa loves birds. And finally, Antonio Rudiger. This one, according to lifeblogger.com, which, by the way, I don't know if anybody's come across this. It's really invaluable for me finding facts about players because it seems to have like the most weirdly written childhood story of every player. It's so strange. And I don't know how much of it's true, but that's why I'm saying, according to lifeblogger.com, Rudiger's strengths are as follows. This is what Lifeblogger writes. Rudiger's strengths are: he's compassionate, artistic, intuitive, gentle and wise. Sounds nice, doesn't it? His weaknesses: he could be overly trusting. Okay, that's weird. what he likes?
Is this likes a dating profile?
I don't know. His likes are being alone, sleeping, music, romance, visual media.
Sorry, hang on. He likes swimming. Being alone, but he also likes romance.
Well, those two things work well together. You should know, Alex. Swimming and spiritual themes. He likes spiritual themes. His dislikes: people who claim they know it all. Yeah? Being criticized. The past coming back to haunt. Who likes that? Nobody likes that. And cruelty of any kind. So I just had to read that whole thing because that's great.
Listing being criticised as one of your dislikes is such a cop-out. Like,
yeah, I mean, listening to the past coming back to haunt you. I mean, nobody's ever said, oh, I like that. I liked it when that happened.
Yeah, that's, I really enjoy it when I get those moments. Those are the moments I really live for, you know, when some horrible memory comes shuddering back into my present. Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And the quote, couldn't find it, but basically Antonio Rudiger seems like a really nice guy and only says nice things. So again, similarly, the quote I have here is, "We can't finish the season positively by staying negative." And I thought, you know, maybe that's true, but Luis Suarez would disagree, wouldn't he?
He sounds like a Piscean, and I've just looked at his birthday, and he is. So I think maybe they've just pulled a couple of personality traits from a horoscope and thrown them in as if they're true.
Right. Yeah, I mean, maybe that's it. That's why I said according to lifeblogger.com, because I really don't want to...
It's a good caveat. It's a very good caveat. Yeah. I'm still trying to square up romance and solitude, but...
Well, I mean, we can talk about it after if you want. It's really obvious. I would say, though, most people like most of these things. So I would say, and dislike most of these things. So I imagine...
That's horoscopes, isn't it? They put it in there. What's that thing where you mentally pick out the things that you feel apply to yourself? There's a clever term for
being
it.
Being selective.
I can't remember. No, it's not that. It's more specific.
Lacking any kind of self-awareness.
That would be it, yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's probably the end of today's podcast. Oh, no, it's not, because we have one more feature, And we'll be back after this short break to talk to some new people. Well, they're not new to the TIFO team, but they're new to the podcast. They're guests. What I'm saying is we have two other members of TIFO here to talk about the fantasy football update. Well, we come now to the fantasy football part of the podcast. Somebody asked us the other day for an update, and I remembered, oh yeah, we have a fantasy football league. I don't know about anyone else. I forgot about it. I looked again at my team and noticed that Callum Wilson has been there for some time. So injuries... Seb, Alex, have you changed your teams much recently?
I went for a big change 2 weeks into the season when I played my wild card and changed everybody.
Right.
I feel like
you know
that was
23 game weeks ago, Seb. Yeah.
Yeah, but we haven't embarrassed ourselves. We've been a stable performer. We've held steady in the same position all year. We're okay. We're a bit of a Brighton. Like we promise a lot more than we've delivered, but at some point this season, it's all going to click and it's going to be fine.
Sure, Alex. How have you found it? Because you know you're a self-proclaimed football expert. I'm just curious to know how that's translating into actual results for you.
I changed my phone over about 2 weeks ago, and and I can't actually currently log in to see how it's going.
Well, I can log in for you, and I can tell you how it's going.
That would be helpful. I mean, I haven't changed my team since about the fifth week because I find FPL kind of, I don't know, a bit tedious.
Haven't
really paid any attention.
Don't really think I've changed mine since then. Seb hasn't changed his since the second, so that doesn't count. I'm just going to let you know that you got 28 points this game week. You've got two Liverpool fullbacks in your defensive lineup. Great idea. And other than that, you've got Mohamed Salah, who presumably has been your captain for almost every game week since this has started.
Something like
that. So, you know, a little bit of bad luck there. I'm just going to tell you that... we have two different leagues going because in the TIFO Football League, there are thousands and thousands of people and I couldn't ever find anybody else. So we also have a little TIFO Team League. Currently, I'm ahead of both Seb and Alex. Now, that's the main reason I was keen to do this this update here for listeners because, you know, I think it shows really who actually has the footballing brain. I'm on 1340, respectable score. I've been pretty much evenly ahead of Seb the entire time, who was on 1287, and Alex there lingering almost in last place on 1157. But we've got a special treat for listeners today. There are actually seven people in our TIFO team league. TIFO as a group is obviously bigger than Alex, Seb and I, and we don't talk about the other people very much because they're intended to sit in the background and make us look better. In fact, they're not really real people. They're really just support for my ego. But we have brought a couple of them here today because three of the team are actually doing better than any of the football experts. So in first place, with 14-28 and a whopping game week of 71 points, is our producer, Ali Clarkson. Hi, Ali.
Hello, Joe.
Now, Ali, I think it would be worthwhile you just introducing yourself to the TIFO listeners and telling people what you do here.
Yeah, I mainly just massage your ego, Joe.
That's pretty much true. It's pretty much true, but with a practical point of view. Ali runs our YouTube channel and all of our social media and does all sorts of things that help out the rest of the team. Ali's currently sitting top of the league. Ali, let me ask you, what's your secret there, Ali? What's your secret?
You've got to have a base of the big name players. And I know you guys like to find the niche ones that might, you know, score you loads of points or might not score your points, but you've got to have those big hitters in there, like Salah and Fernandes and you know.
You mean like Rafinha and Bamford, who are two of your big hitters?
Yeah, they're my secret weapons. They were my secret weapons last week. So I actually have been keeping an eye on my team, and every now and then I bring in a couple of players that I think that might score me some points, and Rafinha was that one.
So well, is that just players that are up against Southampton that week?
There you go, a little glimpse there into the terse interpersonal relationships we have here at TIFO. Strange dynamic. We also have another special guest. Now, this person I've brought on because she's actually last in the league. And I also wanted to know, Alice, you are my sister rather than my wife, as some people think. Hello, Alice. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Joe. It's good to clear that up straight away, isn't it? Always.
It is. And I feel like we should do that every time we talk to each other. Alice, you're last in the league. You have over 1,000 points, though, 1,015 points. You had a better game week this week than Alex. So there's that. What's your secret?
I would like to say, Joe, that I've checked every week. I've made a lot of changes. And I definitely still had the app installed on my phone before you asked me onto this podcast.
Yes, that makes sense as to why you're scoring. You don't actually have that bad of a team. You have got Van Dijk in there, and you've got Cash and Koch, and you've got four people who are permanently injured for the entire season. So that's probably one of the reasons.
Yeah.
You also have Alexander Arnold. You got Rashford there in midfield, and Tammy Abraham as your captain. And I think Tammy Abraham hasn't been starting that many games, so that's probably why. It's not a terrible team, but yes, I think it suffers from lack of observation.
The key to the initial setup of this was in a mixture of which illustrations that I've done that were my favourite. So that was really the basis of my team.
Well, that's good. Well, I've got you here. Would you like to tell people what it is that you do here? You're the managing illustrator, Alice.
Yeah, that's true. I am the managing illustrator, which sounds quite important, doesn't it? So yeah,
it is important.
It's important. We actually have a growing team, so we have four other illustrators now.
Do you mean team is expanding in size, or that the individual people within the team are still growing? Because yeah, I don't want to be confused with someone who uses child labour. Sure.
They're coming up to six now. It's evolving in many ways, Joe. Aesthetically, technically, and in size. And I guess I'm in charge of that. But I also do some of the videos myself, and I sort of oversee all of the design. Anything that is a picture, come to me.
Yeah, we've got a very special video coming out on the 12th of March, haven't we? Now, without sort of giving too many details away, we could tell you that it is 18 minutes long, I think, and very exciting and looks lovely, doesn't it?
Can we say who it's by, or is that too much?
Yeah, you can say that.
It's a James Montague piece for anybody that is an avid watcher of TIFO. They'll probably know who he is, and it's amazing every time I get to work with one of his scripts.
Yeah, there we go. Well, to Ali Clarkson and Alice Devine, thanks to you both for appearing on today's podcast. Much appreciated, and good luck with your fantasy football teams for the remainder of the season.
Cheers, Joe. Thank you, Joe.
There we go. Now to the important bit. Clear off these fools, these meaningless fools. The actual TIFO League. Wow, there are thousands and thousands of people in there. Unsurprisingly, no one from the TIFO team appears in the top 10 of this list. But Seb has kindly screenshot it for me so I can look. And I can tell you that Intersonal, I guess that's a kind of Arsenal thing. Intersonal by Sir Aboeid, currently leading the league with 17-16. Now, this is very exciting because this week, I believe there's been some change in the top three places. It looks like Jono Brown, who is now in third place, who had a game week of 65 with 17-11. It looked like Jono Brown was first before this week. So, sorry to you, Jono. You've fallen off. Ivan Andraz with Washington Gunners. Second place with 17-15. And in fourth place, the team with my favourite name, Spuds. Simon H. With 17-01. Congratulations to you four. You win nothing because we didn't organise anything. It's only game week 25 or whatever it is, so calm down. Don't get too excited. And even if you were there at the end of game week 38, you wouldn't win anything anyway, because this is just not that kind of gig, man. Okay, so just relax. But enjoy yourself, Spud, and Sir Aboeid. You know, congratulations. I hope that satiates the listeners who were looking for a fantasy footballing update. We'll be back again with this, probably, I'll say, with an asterisk, before the end of the season, if not at the end of the season, to review the final results. Although I will say that our TIFO team has held fairly tight for the entire way through. Philippe Fenner just taking over me this week, and he has actually been fired, so we won't ever hear from him. Okay, well, that was that bit. Thanks, everyone. Well, now, there we go. Wasn't that all fun? A lovely episode for people. Hope you enjoyed listening today. Alex Stewart, thanks to you.
Thanks very much, Joe.
And thanks to you, Seb Stafford-Blore.
Thank you, Joe Devine.
We'll be back on Tuesday with some more game-relevant podcasting, and I hope you all have a fantastic weekend. Au revoir.
Athletic.